What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Caitlin Long spent 22 years on Wall Street, including stints at Morgan Stanley, Credit Suisse, and Salomon Brothers. She's been a Bitcoin proponent since 2012, and most recently helped the state of Wyoming adopt crypto-friendly legislation. In this conversation, we cover why Wall Street may not be Bitcoin's friend, how the Bitcoin ETF could actually be a bad idea, and whether or not Wall Street could actually kill Bitcoin. I really enjoyed learning from Caitlin and hope you find this recording just as valuable as I did. Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All right, guys, we're here with Caitlin Long. Super excited about this conversation. Thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you. It's nice to finally meet you.
Absolutely. Let's just go through your background, but I don't want you to kind of gloss over anything. I want you to actually go through every step of it so we can really get into kind of the Wall Street aspect and then how you got into crypto.
Been in crypto since early, probably 2013. I discovered it in 2012. Didn't actually get my first Bitcoins until 2013. Had to keep my head down. So, and the reason is because I was on Wall Street at that time. I was running a business at Morgan Stanley and spent 22 years in total on Wall Street from 94 through 2016. Have a legal background, although I've never practiced law. I've been a member of the bar since way back when. Prior to that, grew up in Wyoming, which is going to be relevant, I think, when we
Absolutely.
Talk about the Wyoming blockchain bills. Yeah.
So, when you get to Wall Street, what was kind of your first job? And then walk me through the different, you know, parts of the business on Wall Street.
I worked in investment banking at Salomon Brothers doing financial institutions. So just, landed there by luck, not a particular interest. It's just that's where I got assigned.
Absolutely.
And found financial institutions incredibly interesting. So did a lot of work in bank mergers and insurance company mergers, and I ended up kind of steering over towards insurance. I find that a fascinating industry, and all of the 22 years had something to do with insurance that I worked on Wall Street.
So. Why is that so interesting?
Well, it's the law of large numbers. It's actually a really math based industry. So part of the reason I didn't practice law is I discovered I was better at math than words. To put it simply, and so the math has always interested me, and I don't have a high level math background like a cryptographer would, but I knew enough to know, and ended up running a couple of insurance companies within Wall Street firms during those years.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so walk me through. You're on Wall Street. You know, at that point, you'd been there almost 20 years, right? And what's the first time somebody tells you about Bitcoin, or you kind of stumble across it, and what was your reaction?
Yeah, it was the libertarian community. It was Free State Group. I discovered Austrian economics out of curiosity during the 2008 financial crisis. I figured out that the mainstream explanation of the financial crisis just didn't make sense. And it was a contradiction that Tim Geithner made on Charlie Rose's show, where he talked about how interest rates were too low going into the crisis. And he had just been arguing that interest rates needed to be lowered still. And so obviously that I just thought it was illogical and dug. And at the time, stayed in touch with a lot of hedge fund friends. Yep. They were all trying to figure everything out. They had found Austrian economics before the financial crisis in a lot of cases, but they dug in, and they even pointed me to the Garrison PowerPoints. That's an obscure Austrian reference that a lot of folks probably, a lot of your listeners will understand. But if you haven't seen those, they are incredible.
Absolutely. And so as you're kind of going into that rabbit hole and you're discovering all this stuff, you hear about Bitcoin. What's kind of that first reaction?
Oh, I didn't believe it. And it was also, in those days, there was no UI. And so I'm not a technologist by background, yep. and I was intimidated by it and just scratched my head and couldn't believe it, like a lot of people. And you start reading, the reason I remember it was February 2013 when I first started to set up a wallet is Jeffrey Tucker sent an email around. And in fact, a few months ago, I actually saved that email and I had sent it back to Jeffrey a few months ago to remind him of when's the first time he started writing about Bitcoin. It was in an email on Laissez-Faire Books. And I happened to be flat on my back after having had a surgery for a couple of days, so I had time to really dig into it. It takes time, and it takes a lot of repetition. And Jeffrey had some how-to advice in that email. It was never published on a website, although when I sent it back to him a couple of months ago, he published it just so he could kind of have a record of it. Yeah.
And so where'd you go to buy Bitcoin, right? So this is 2013. It's pretty early. There's not really that many places where, you know, one, people are talking about this stuff, and then two, kind of what I would consider a really great user experience or a user interface. So without the technology background, what do you do?
Yeah, that was the... There was an ATM up at Liberty Forum.
Amazing.
My very first Bitcoin came from the blockchain.info guys. They were up at Liberty Forum explaining, and they hosted a how-to, and it was very well attended by a lot of curious people, and set up another wallet through them, and then they sent us a few Satoshis. And then I went out and put $20 into a Bitcoin ATM. Yeah.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
All right. So we go from 2013 to over the next 2-3 years, kind of what is your relationship with Bitcoin, crypto? I'm assuming you go deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole, get more excited about it.
Yeah.
Still on Wall Street?
Still on Wall Street. And a very good friend of mine, Ari Levy Cohen, who's one of the co-founders of Singular DTV, he was also at Morgan Stanley at the time, and he had gone down the rabbit hole, and more so than I, and more technologically savvy than I was, and so, you know, was already digging. He was already running a full node, I think, at that point, and so he was really helpful to me in understanding it. And there was another the third of the three Morgan Stanley musketeers, Jake Dienelt, who you probably crossed paths with. Unfortunately, he passed away, as you know, but the three of us came from very different parts of Morgan Stanley, and we connected with each other over Bitcoin. I'd known Ari previously, but we really got to know each other more closely
over
Bitcoin.
It's like the secret society of crypto on Wall Street.
Well, and there was an internal Morgan Stanley Bitcoin email list, a forum that got going. And what was fun about it is when I joined it, there were already probably, I don't know, 50 people on it. Mm-hmm. And it grew to hundreds of people
And this is like 2014, 2015?
Yeah, 2014. And, you know, everybody was afraid, right, of the compliance department. No one knew what the implications for being involved with this would be. Mm-hmm. And so in the beginning, I just lurked. And I noticed that most of the people were younger, and i.e. more junior. But they were all from all over the place. It wasn't just the technology department, and it wasn't just the United States. It was literally all over the world, a very diverse cross-section of people who were interested in this. And it just really blossomed. And as it blossomed, I started to participate. And then I got a phone call from the chief technology officer, because I was a managing director running a business. And so, you know, I had a little gray hair, so to speak. And he said, come on into my office and tell me what this is. And, the board had, it turned out, just asked him at the time, I think this was 2014, to make sure that he understood what this was and didn't miss it.
Because
the hype was starting to form already by that time. And I had already been in several meetings. The first blockchain company that I met at Morgan Stanley was Ripple. Mm-hmm. They came in through a friend, and he pulled me in not knowing I knew anything about Bitcoin. And I remember about 5 minutes into the meeting, putting my pen down and saying, oh my God, this is going to tip. and all the Morgan Stanley people, that we were arrayed across the table from Chris Larson and Patrick Griffith and the whole Ripple team at the time. There were probably five of them and then five of us. And the Morgan Stanley people looked at me like I was just from Mars. They were like, what the heck? Because they didn't know anything about what the Ripple folks were saying. And I just remember Chris Larson, the look on his face, he relaxed, because he knew he wasn't fighting an uphill battle to educate everybody on the other side of the table. And it was just like the smile that came across his face when
he found a champion.
And at that point, that was the first time I realized that you could apply this technology to the mainstream financial sector. And it took a while for me to make that connection, because the I didn't understand that you could separate, in quote unquote, separate the blockchain from Bitcoin. Of course you can't, and we can probably talk a little bit more about that later. I'm one of many who made a detour around enterprise blockchain and have come back. Jimmy Song just gave a great interview a few weeks back to Laura Shin about that, mm-hmm. about his trip through
do you think this is really important, right? So do you think that it's almost a requirement in order to start out, get excited, you find out the technology, and then you have to explore all of the intellectually possible scenarios,
sure.
and then you end up coming back to what is in reality probably the most likely application?
Well, it's interesting. That's what Jimmy did, and he's obviously a technologist, mm-hmm. so we came at it from different perspectives, but both ended up in the same place, essentially concluding, you know, the enterprise stuff is okay for things probably outside of financial services, mm-hmm. right? Supply chain is where it's taking off. Do you really need a blockchain for that? Probably mm-hmm. not. But the truth is that it's a marketing gig, and it's causing some very interesting things to happen in supply chain. There's a company in Wyoming called Beef Chain that is doing exactly that, to track the provenance of Wyoming beef. It's solving a problem that nobody knew how to solve, and now this technology has sort of opened up the conversation. So I don't mean to impugn enterprise blockchain across the board, but I do believe, and I did say in a Forbes column recently, a lot of enterprise blockchain was essentially made obsolete by the ICE announcement, because what ICE did was break the seal in embracing digitally native assets.
Yep.
And that's what Jimmy said to Laura was ultimately why he concluded that it was very difficult to apply blockchain, not Bitcoin, so to speak, to the enterprise world, because you have a lot of things like trade breaks and reversals that the regulators have to be able to come in. So effectively, the regulators have to be a super node, and therefore you really aren't decentralized. Therefore, you're better off working in a centralized database architecture. To paraphrase Jimmy's, I hope I haven't misstated. I came at it from a different perspective, which was I knew that Wall Street wasn't going to accept Bitcoin. So I was more from a legal and compliance perspective thinking, all right, how do we actually figure out how to go through that intermediate step of the walled garden, to use Andreas's phrase, where you know, the intranet first before internet. That's the way enterprises think. They don't take big leaps. They do take more incremental steps. And nobody was interested in wholesale replacing their IT architecture, in yep. which they've invested billions. So I knew this was going to be a slow process. But I was pleasantly surprised by the ICE announcement that they are embracing natively digital assets. That is a big deal, because that means they just leapfrogged over that whole tokenization, mm-hmm. blockchain, not Bitcoin philosophy. And ICE can do a lot that's very positive with that. I hope they do.
Absolutely. So one thing that we spend a lot of time thinking about is this idea that, you know, you can own four types of assets, right? Stocks, bonds, currencies, commodities. And in this digital world, there should be digital yep. stocks, bonds, currencies, yep. and commodities, right? And so Bitcoin being probably the most attractive asset to date,
yep.
right, in the currency bucket.
Yep.
And over time, as these other assets or digital assets get introduced, how does Wall Street interact with that, right? Because I think to your point, they're more evolutionary than revolutionary.
Yes.
How do you, you know, see this playing out? And should, frankly, the crypto community trust Wall Street?
Well, that latter question is a whole can of worms. but how I think this is going to play out is, look, we all understand that natively digital assets can trade and settle instantly,
mm-hmm.
and or in near real time, the technologists would correct me, but a lot faster than the trade date plus two days settlement that we have now on Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
And it's going to cut out a lot of the intermediaries that take cuts and create counterparty risk where it otherwise would not exist.
Yep.
So I actually think very much that the ICO craze, a lot of folks are thinking that there's a lot of scams, and of course there are, but there's something really important from a corporate finance perspective that comes out of that, which is that investors are rationally, in my opinion, willing to give up the traditional covenants and preferences that they're used to getting in investments in exchange for not having to deal with this crazy trading, clearing, and settlement infrastructure on Wall Street, which exposes them to all kinds of risks that they just don't need to be exposed to. So they get instant settlement with no counterparty risk if they are trading these utility tokens or security tokens.
How much of that is driven by human greed and just the idea that price will appreciate? And so,
a lot of it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So talk to me about, do you think that investors are actually making a rational trade-off in terms of, hey, I actually don't like that, you know, settlement system, and so therefore I'm willing to give up? Or do you think some of it is human greed, and by proxy, that's what the trade-off that they're making?
I think it's the latter. I'm not sure that a lot of folks are necessarily going through that thought process that we just talked about. They instinctively understand that they outright own this asset. It's not an IOU from anyone. And therefore, I'd rather own that. It's real property. It's something that I can maintain on my own. And if my broker dealer goes bust, I'm not stuck as an unsecured creditor to a leveraged institution like the customers of MF Global or Lehman Brothers were.
Absolutely.
Right, where they end up taking a haircut. Right. So I think a lot of people do intuitively understand that. How are they actually rationally making applying a probability and a loss severity to a broker dealer default when they buy securities? Probably not. But again, this is the wisdom of crowds, right? There it is intuitive. And I also do believe that this market has shown that the crowdfunding rules and the Jobs Act that Congress passed to help make crowdfunding a lot easier, they failed. Mm-hmm. And they failed because of the bureaucracy involved in raising capital. Mm-hmm. So what this market, I think, is doing is pushing, I hope, the policymakers towards, let's actually have a Jobs Act 2 that actually tears down even more of those bureaucratic barriers, because it's pretty clear that there is something special here in the structure of these ICOs, and let's actually help clarify the regulations. So far, the SEC has not been friendly to that, but there are folks on Congress who are.
Absolutely. It's almost like we're going back to the beginning of equity investing, et cetera, right? In terms of when people first started investing in companies, there was no such thing as liquidity preferences or shareholder rights, et cetera. But you actually had the bearer instrument, right?
You did.
You actually owned your shares. And so we've almost come full circle to an extent just now in the digital world, right? And so how do you see that ripple impact across Wall Street, right? If the retail investors are willing to do this without going through financial institutions, does that force the financial institutions to, you know, kind of move in this direction as well? Or do you think that they can hold out?
They're going to be forced to move in this direction because they're just going to be disintermediated. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating to me is that there's a whole parallel infrastructure of Wall Street, right? There are structurers of these capital raises. We call them ICOs, but they can be security token offerings, whatever you want to call it. There's a whole capital market that's built up around these products. So you've got the advisors, you've got the exchanges, you've got research firms that specialize in all of this, and Wall Street is going to get disintermediated by them. And the thing that Wall Street does not offer right now, and frankly isn't set up very well to do it, is to be able to build tech. You don't have people who can design an ERC-20 token and understand how to market an ICO or an STO out to the investor universe. That's not something Wall Street can do. But I've had a number of companies talk to me about corporate coins, corporate ERC-20 tokens. And I think it's very real. It's as I've said in one of the Forbes.com pieces, this is actually, I think, cheaper capital. It's securitization by another name. And so for a company to go out and raise capital that way is very rational. And I think that they're going to find cheaper capital either for startups. And we've seen that, right? The amount of VC investment in this industry compared to the token investment in this industry, the tokens surpassed VC investment in blockchain 18 months ago. But now the whole token industry is 30% of what traditional VC across the board, not just blockchain, right? This is, it's already happening. That's already disintermediating. And it's 45% of the size of the IPOs in the first quarter, in the second quarter. And 41%, I think, was the number in the first quarter. So it wasn't just a flash in the pan. It's, we've had 6 months of, you know, that this token market has raised a very material amount of capital, institutional sized, and that is attracting companies to this market. I think we're going to see, you know, more than just Kodak Coin.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, I think a lot about like this power shift, right? So if you think of when investing first started, the founders or owners of the business had a lot of the power.
Yep.
And so they would go to people and say, hey, give me money. You can have a claim on my cash flow.
Yep.
Over time, investors realized, hey, we have money. And so we've got some leverage here. And they continued to kind of ratchet down on business owners or founders. And now what we're seeing is a shift in power back to those founders and entrepreneurs, because what we're doing is on a global basis, you just open it up and there's always an investor who's willing to take less egregious terms.
Right? Yeah, but I also think that it is a trade-off. The market's actually been pretty good at weeding out the scams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the benefits of crypto Twitter is that you know, people are pretty
ruthless.
Yeah. and so if it's just an outright scam, mm-hmm.
But I think there's a difference,
information,
right? Because I think the detail here matters.
So
there's a difference between a scam,
yep,
and let's say a founder who says, look, when I raise capital, I'm looking for two things.
Yes.
I'm looking for money, and
yep,
I'm looking for help,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And so if I believe that there's an investor who will give me money and help, but the terms are erroneous,
yes,
right, or kind of egregious,
yes,
then I'm willing to open that up to a wider set of investors.
Absolutely.
To find a better market equilibrium for what this round pricing should be.
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things that comes out of that is that this is a big competitive threat to the state of Delaware. And having worked while I was at Symbiont, mm-hmm, it was Symbiont's idea to go start the Delaware Blockchain Initiative. Mark Smith got that done before I got to Symbiont, and we were gung-ho moving forward with the former governor, and then the incumbents came in and then threw sand in the wheels under the new governor, and here's the irony. Based on what ICE just announced, that it's going to natively digital assets, it just takes away Delaware's competitive advantage.
Yep.
I don't see any reason why a company, a startup would register in Delaware. Why? Because of exactly what you just talked about. They now have a capital markets alternative where they don't have to go and be a Delaware corporation, where investors really are most comfortable with the state of Delaware because the law is defined there. There's great case law, there's the,
yep,
Delaware Chancery Court, all of those things fit the traditional corporate equity issuance and preferred share venture capital funding model.
Mm-hmm.
But now, if you can actually issue tokens, you're just going to have a very different looking balance sheet. You're just going to have a big contingent liability on your balance sheet, but it doesn't matter where you organize as a company, because you're not raising capital by selling equity. You're raising capital through this securitization type, secured financing type of vehicle, which means that Delaware law is not a competitive advantage at all. And I find that it's just disappointing. Delaware squandered its huge head start. We're 2.5 years after the announcement of the Delaware Blockchain Initiative. And of course, they were working on it before Governor Markell,
yep,
announced it at Consensus in 2016, that was, I think, April. And they are just maybe later this year, I think, going to have a prototype to consider at the state of Delaware. So, I mean, it's just, it's pretty clear what happened there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for them.
So sticking with state-specific legislation, let's go to Wyoming,
mm-hmm,
right? You've done an incredible job there. Walk us through, there's 5 pieces of legislation.
Yep.
Just walk us through kind of what happened and kind of where we are today and why Wyoming has been able to kind of get this stuff across the finish line.
Well, it was just a fortuitous thing. I was just quietly, because I happened to get into Bitcoin pretty early, had like a lot of folks' gains and was, mm-hmm, willing to share the wealth and also wanted to solve a problem, which is that there are not a lot of female engineers. And out there, not just in this industry, but across the board, my dad had been department head of electrical engineering at the University of Wyoming. So I thought, well, just this, you know, endowing with Bitcoin gains a fund for female engineers checked
Amazing.
A lot of my boxes, right? And I just quietly did it. I wasn't telling anyone about it. And just assumed the University of Wyoming could, you know, get an account with Coinbase. I used to be on the foundation board there. So I was, you know, helping them through that. And then ran smack dab into the Wyoming law problem, which was that they had one of the worst money transmission laws, and was one of three states Coinbase couldn't do business in, and nor could BitPay or Circle and or any of the other competitors. And so I said, guys, let's go fix that. And it turned into, let's more than fix that. Let's actually, you know, define utility tokens as a new class of property, digital property, that is exempt from securities laws and from money transmission laws. And we exempted open blockchain tokens from property taxes. We did all kinds of interesting things that basically made it a very crypto-friendly state. It is the most crypto-friendly state right now.
Absolutely. And so what do you think that does? Obviously, it's going to incentivize people to move to Wyoming, their business, right, in terms of to get a lot of this work done there. Do you think that it can have an impact on other states or at the federal level?
Well, great question. Wyoming is the state that invented the limited liability company in 1977. So it wasn't actually that far-fetched that it was going to be doing some interesting things, because it has a history, like Delaware, of being a leader in a particular type of business entity formation. And so we wanted to, but Delaware stepped in and sort of stole Wyoming's lead over the years as being the place where most LLCs formed. And so this was a chance for Wyoming to try to steal that lead back. you know, it's been good. A lot of folks have formed companies in Wyoming. I haven't looked at the recent numbers, but I just see it through the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition. Still, every day, a couple of companies reach out looking for attorneys in Wyoming, looking for references for people who can help them structure their token offering. You asked a question about the federal impact. There definitely are some congressmen who watched what happened in Wyoming and who very much like what happened in Wyoming. But the federal issue is a whole new can of worms. And it's fascinating because securities law has been adjudicated by the Supreme Court to be a federal jurisdiction, but property is the jurisdiction of the states. So actually, in the next Wyoming legislative session, the task force that I'm on, we're going to have a couple of new bills, and one of them is going to actually pull out the utility token language from the securities title, which is where it resides right now in the chapter, if you will, of Wyoming law that is securities. It's an exemption from securities. We're actually going to pull it out and create it as a new class of property. That is, for the legal-minded folks out there, the Uniform Commercial Code is state law. Commerce is state law. And so if we can actually get it into a classification of property as opposed to securities, it actually increases the probability that if there ever is litigation, that a judge is going to say that's not federal jurisdiction. So we're setting it up for folks to come in who want to stay in the United States, but recognize that there's legal risk. I'm certainly not advising folks to do anything without getting independent counsel. I'm not giving legal or investment advice here, but we have had a number of companies who have very publicly said they want to stay in the United States and they're coming to Wyoming because they just don't believe that the federal government should be running American businesses offshore.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. What's something that you believe in the crypto space that you think a wide majority of people would disagree with you on?
That Bitcoin's going to take over as money. That's the, I really do believe Bitcoin's going to take
over
as money.
Okay, oh, yeah. Explain to us the logic of how you get there.
Well, I think it's going to take 20 years. I may be wrong, because again, what ICE did, that's one of the benefits of what ICE did, was embrace natively digital assets. And so I think that changeover from how we do it now, where we have this crazy system where every financial asset, with very few exceptions, is an IOU from a leveraged financial institution that might go bust. Most people don't realize that. Yes, the stocks in your brokerage account are not stocks. They're an IOU from your broker. The bank account deposits that you have, it's not your money. It's an IOU from a bank, and they may not pay it back to you. So I do think that I thought that it would take a while to tear down that infrastructure, and I do think it will take a while. But that's why I said ICE broke the seal. That's one of the things I complimented them on. They leapt over the blockchain, not Bitcoin, detour, if you will, that I thought was going to take the industry 10 or 20 years and just went straight to natively digital assets. So I, you know, we may be surprised at how fast this takes off. The technology needs to come up to speed pretty clearly. I'm excited about Lightning Network. Now that I understand what that is, in not certainly at a technologist depth, but more sort of from a philosopher and business depth of understanding, that, you know, that really That's could exciting. Make a big difference. Yeah.
Do you think that the adoption of Bitcoin as money is being accelerated by some of the hyperinflation we're seeing around the world?
Oh, no question. Yeah. No question. We're on the day where we're recording this is, you know, Turkey is we're having an emerging market correction, shall we say, in a number of emerging markets. And yeah, the Bitcoin's already having a big impact in places like Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And historically, it has been a safe haven asset. The Wall Street flows did make it more positively correlated to traditional financial assets. It was, say, in the Cyprus situation, very non-correlated. It was a safe haven flow. And one of the things that I've literally just written in the book chapter draft is that Bitcoin will return to its roots as a safe haven asset. It is.
Very, very interesting. And if that occurs, and given what ICE just did, do you think ICE is one of, or the most important company in crypto right now?
I do, and it's a double-edged sword. I've been positive about them in the conversation here that we've recorded so far. But as you know, as we were chatting earlier, there are definitely a lot of downsides to the way that Wall Street is going to approach mm-hmm. Bitcoin.
What's the biggest fear there?
Well, they're going to rehypothecate it, and they're going to create more claims to Bitcoin than actually exist. And it's so fascinating than the 17 million Bitcoins that exist. It's so fascinating to talk to both the Wall Street folks as well as the crypto folks in folks understanding what that really means. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of my Wall Street compatriots don't understand that that's a big part. Rehypothecation is a big part of how Wall Street makes money. Mm-hmm. It creates more paper claims than there are actual assets. So the Dole Food case is exhibit A for that. 49.2 million brokerage statements saying that the folks owned Dole Food shares, but there were really only 36.7 million shares outstanding. And all 49.2 million brokerage statements were valid. That was a Delaware court case. How did the financial system create one-third more claims to Dole Food shares than there were real Dole Food shares? It's the market for pledged collateral. It's mm-hmm. it's all the securities lending, rehypothecation, and the like that takes place on Wall Street, where the accounting systems lose track of who really owns what, and basically turning those assets into IOUs. If you actually owned the real Dole Food shares, you would never have had anything like that happen.
Yep.
If you own the real Bitcoin, you will never have anything like that happen. But Wall Street, that is a big part of their business model. They want to intermediate trades. And so if they can inflate the number of underlying assets, they intermediate more trades. And a lot of folks have been shocked on the crypto side to hear this is how Wall Street works. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there have been some Wall Street people who stood up in the Twitter debates and said and defended this. And that is absolutely a rational position. They're defending it as this is what brings liquidity to markets. This is what greases the skids of trading. And this is what's going to bring liquidity to Bitcoin. And a very respected person actually said to me that this is, I won't identify folks just because these are not personal debates. They're substantive mm-hmm. debates. And I don't want to personalize it. But said to me that Wall Street is going to fix the quote unquote problem that Bitcoin has, which is that it is limited to 21 million coins, and that scarcity is its quote-unquote problem. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely how Wall Street thinks about it. But the crypto folks, obviously,
they
that's like, no, well, that, but they love the scarcity. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But listening to and reading the quotes from the CEO of ICE talking about needing to centralize Bitcoin, talking about needing to bring trust and transparency to Bitcoin, these are just antithetical to Bitcoin. And the crypto folks are, you know, number of people use the word cringeworthy when hearing them talk about this. But the Wall Street folks read that and say, well, exactly. there's such a misunderstanding between the two, but it is not just a communication misunderstanding. It is a deep philosophical difference.
Absolutely. What do you wish that people on Wall Street understood about the crypto community that maybe they don't? Like what is the biggest disconnect that if that got solved, you think a lot of this would kind of be easier?
That we're all druggies and dark web users and there's still an enormous overhang of that perception.
Absolutely.
in the community from Wall Street's perspective.
I say all the time, I say the currency of choice of every drug dealer, terrorist, you know, money launderer in the world
is the US dollar. You're right, 100% right.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other piece too, I think that, you know, Wall Street hasn't yet figured out is there's a gentleman I know in the law enforcement community who said, look, from our perspective, we want every criminal to commit crimes with their hands on a keyboard.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so Bitcoin is a perfect example of what can occur when there is the, you know,
right,
kind of the trackability, et cetera, of a currency.
It's more trackable than U.S. dollars for sure. And I believe FinCEN's, the new head of FinCEN just came out and said that speaking at a Bitcoin conference or blockchain event in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, and said exactly that. This is actually more traceable than the U.S. dollar now that they understand how to trace it.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's fast forward. Wall Street bangs their head against the wall for a while, right? ICE kind of broke the seal. We 10, 15, 20 years from now, what do quote unquote retail products in crypto look like once Wall Street gets involved? Like what do you think are the kind of most obvious things? Is it an ETF? Is it something else? What does that look like?
Well, I do think it's an ETF. And again, that's a double-edged sword. There are a lot of folks who are thinking that that's going to be a savior of the price correction that we've had in crypto. And I'm not so sure about that. I just saw Tor de Meester make reference to the when the gold ETF was introduced. I think gold prices were up 350% within that period. And there's a big difference between what Wall Street was back then in 2004 and what Wall Street is today. There's so much more securities lending and reapothecation of collateral than happened back then. And so the price action was more pure. And now I'm not so sure because I was just talking over the weekend up at a Free State picnic with some folks who work in the Wall Street industry. We were just comparing notes and we were talking about the securities lending market and how basically after the financial crisis, so many of the mutual funds, especially defined contribution plans like 401ks, turned off securities lending after the Northern Trust Fund had a problem with securities lending. And the entire defined contribution market went non-lending. A lot of the defined benefit market went non-lending as well. And everyone in the lending market thought, well, gosh, securities are, we're going to have a lot more, you know, spreads are going to widen out. We're going to make more profit on what we're trading. And we're going to have a lot more scarce assets, the sort of hard to borrow or special assets that are so meaty for Wall Street to intermediate because the profit margins are so wide. And guess what? Actually, the number of scarce and hard to borrow assets went down.
Wow.
You took out the entire defined contribution and defined benefits markets out of securities lending. How did that happen? The reason is because the accounting systems are manipulatable, shall we say? So I don't think that looking back at the 2004 gold example is actually, we're not going to see a replay of that because Wall Street has figured out how to rehypothecate assets. And that whole securities finance market has now consolidated. It used to be very disparate, but what was happening was the hedge funds were arbing the investment banks' funding desks themselves. So they'd go to the prime brokerage desk and put on one side of the trade and then take the other side of the trade with the repo desk at the same investment bank and collapse and collect a spread because the two parts of the investment bank weren't working with each other and they were pricing things differently. And now what's happened is that's all consolidated at all the investment banks into one department. And so all those different places where assets are lent and relent in any sort of rehypothecation, I'm using that form, that term very broadly, but that's how Wall Street makes its money. And there's so much more of that than happened back 15, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. We talk a lot about the decentralization of the currency prevents it from being killed by a government.
Yep.
Do you think that some of Wall Street's tactics can kill Bitcoin?
Well, I think they can rehypothecate it. Mm-hmm. I put out a piece yesterday, the R and C words, reapothecation and commingling. Excuse me, those are dirty words. Mm-hmm. But that is how Wall Street makes its money. And what's fascinating, this is kind of an inside baseball, you're a financial guy, this is kind of an inside baseball piece, and I would have thought that it wouldn't have gotten much play, but it was already probably about 20 hours after putting it up, it's already had more than 6,000 views.
Wow.
So a lot of people are wanting to learn. They understand that there's something here. And I don't mean to be the bearer of the news. Some folks have wanted to shoot the messenger, but I stood up the moment that ICE came out and announced it and said, this is not good for the price of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You know, look at what's happened since then. It's had about a 20% correction. A lot of folks said, a lot of folks expected this to be a huge positive, right? And I'm so sympathetic and feel the same myself. Empathetic, probably a better word, about wanting to have the mainstream acceptance that we've all been craving. This is validation that we have something really special here, and we're no longer these sort of, you know, kids off in the corner playing with their, you know, fancy tech toy. We're being taken seriously, and there's so much positive to take away from that. But it is a double-edged sword, and I do believe that it has suppressed the price. And the reason is because now it's hard to say everything that has suppressed the price. But
absolutely,
if you look at it that day, it's pretty clear that ICE news actually, there was a lot of selling in Bitcoin that day, and that was the only news that particular day. It was a week ago Friday.
Absolutely. What if you're sitting there and you're running a Wall Street bank today, right? You're Diamond or whoever, right? And you see this asset class emerge, start to grow,
yep,
and you say, I'm willing to sacrifice my short-term profits for long-term sustainability with this as a mainstream asset class. What do you do, right? What would you do as the head of that Wall Street bank?
Well, I think you do what Goldman does, and I've multiple times written that Goldman was the one among the banks that was different. When I and my colleagues at Morgan Stanley were going to meetups clandestinely on, you know, after hours and on weekends in, you know, 2014, trying to keep our heads down and not reveal to the world that we who we worked for, and not to reveal our interest internally either, and our day job. Goldman folks were the ones that didn't feel that. There was an acceptance, a cultural acceptance within Goldman of accepting curiosity and mm-hmm. accepting wanting to branch out and think outside the box, and the other investment banks all seem to ratchet that down. And I just was chatting with somebody who's working at another investment bank literally yesterday, and he said, you know, the compliance department is still, these things are so risky, and it's dark web, and no one, mm-hmm. you can't verify the counterparty on the other side, and very negative still. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the banks are still being, you know, run by their compliance departments in that regard, but they're missing out. So why am I singling out Goldman? Goldman is, you know, they're putting together a crypto trading desk. Lloyd Blankfein was at the time the CEO, one of the only Wall Street titans who actually came out and said positive things about Bitcoin, and said, you know, there was a time when paper money was thought of, looked at askance as well. This was when Jamie Dimon famously said he'd fire anyone. And when he said that, I understood that, because that's exactly how I felt if I popped my head up at Morgan Stanley at the time. And a lot of these banks have pushed out their crypto people, and now, ironically, they're scrambling to find them.
Absolutely. It is an exciting time that we're living through. What's the one area people aren't talking about that you think they should be?
Well, this Wall Street.
The Wall Street stuff.
The Wall Street entry. This is a big deal, and it's clear that it's going to take a lot of patient education mm-hmm. of folks to understand, both on the Wall Street side, why it is such a big deal, that you've got now the 10-ton gorilla of market infrastructure in the U.S., embracing natively digital assets. And I think the fixed income market is going to go in that direction pretty mm-hmm. fast, because why would you bother to issue in paper form anymore, in global security form? It just, you know, now that ICE is accepting natively digital assets, game changer for Wall Street. I think a lot of folks don't understand that. And then on the crypto side, it's, wait a minute, Wall Street really isn't your friend here. Yes, they're going to bring liquidity. Yes, they're going to bring institutional investors in, but they're also going to create Bitcoin substitutes off the chain. And it's not as though, you know, the custodial exchanges, someone just today said, hey, Mt. Gox did that. Absolutely. We didn't own real Bitcoins if we owned Bitcoins at Mt. Gox. We owned an IOU for Mt. Gox. And a lot of folks didn't understand that. But I like to repeat what Charlie Shrem has said. You have to lose money in Bitcoin before you make it. I lost some coins in Mt. Gox because that was the place when I was buying that everybody bought. And I didn't fully understand that. But boy, that was really cheap tuition. It was money well spent. That loss to me was money well spent because I learned that lesson. I didn't own real Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I pulled my private keys off and i.e. pulled my Bitcoins off that I understood that I finally owned real Bitcoin.
Absolutely. It's so funny, right? For somebody who learned about in 2012, got in 2013, 2014, right? For us to be sitting here, you know, just a few years later and to be reminding people that Wall Street's not your friend.
Yeah.
Right? That probably wasn't something you had to be saying in 2013,
no.
Right? With the people around the table.
But it's so fascinating. The knee-jerk reaction was, oh my God, this is so positive. And yes, in some ways, but it's not universally positive. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be very patient and respectful because a lot of really smart people just haven't gone down that other side's rabbit hole yet. And it's smart people on both sides. It's the Wall Street people saying, what? ICE is getting into Bitcoin? And it's the crypto people saying, what? We can have off-chain fractionally reserved Bitcoin substitutes?
Mm-hmm.
So it's time for a lot of folks to go down the other side's rabbit hole and really learn.
Well, and I think too, it's a technologist's view, right? It's math, right? And so you kind of look at the numbers that you've got there. When they get exposed to what is essentially financial engineering, right? It's something that they've just never thought about.
Absolutely.
And so it's this, you mean to tell me that people are actually going to buy a thing that represents Bitcoin, but they're not going to buy Bitcoin?
Well, and interestingly, when we start explaining that, and we now the Twitter's gone absolutely nuts. People are talking to each other. A lot of folks really understand this and explain it to and help explain it to peers. People are kind of again realizing, oh my God, you mean that's what Kraken and BitMEX and OKEX are doing? Yeah, they've been doing it all along. They're basically Web 2.0 companies that create a centralized layer. Application layer, and they record transactions to the underlying chain, but they're commingling the Bitcoins in an omnibus account. Anytime you have you use a custodial exchange or a custodian, you store your coins at Coinbase or Circle or BitPay, guess what? You're doing, you have an IOU from them, unless you're in Coinbase Vault, and it's the same thing. And so a lot of folks didn't really realize that. I know Andreas has been trying to help people understand that. You don't own your private keys unless you don't own your Bitcoin unless you have your private keys. He can't repeat that often enough is what I found, because even within the hardcore crypto community, there were a lot of folks who didn't understand that nuance. And so, it's just patient, respectful education. And this ICE news definitely has caused a lot of folks to open up and learn.
Absolutely. We end each podcast. I let you ask me one question. It's my least favorite part of this because I never know what people will ask. But anything that you'd like to ask?
What do you think the ICE implications of Wall Street are? Because I know you've submitted a letter to the SEC regarding the ETFs. Do you agree with my approach?
So I do agree, right? I think that there's two separate pieces here, right? One is I truly believe that there's a lot of people who are interested, they're intrigued, and they don't have the technical competence or the intellectual curiosity to go figure out.
Or the time.
How do I figure out what is Bitcoin, what are the risks associated, what is the potential benefit, and how do I purchase, hold securely, et cetera? All they know is, this Bitcoin thing's interesting. People are talking about it. They keep getting stolen. I'm just going to go about my day, right?
And so
I think when you get an ETF or these retail products, ICE, et cetera, right, there's a line to thread there between you're giving access to a class of investors or you know, a subset of investors that probably would never go to Coinbase, right, and go try to buy
because they want to buy it through their financial advisor. Yeah,
they just want they want somebody to yell at when something goes wrong, right? And so I think that, you know, for those people, this is good because it will give them some exposure, even though it's not the best exposure. At the same time, the financial engineering that comes in is quite scary, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that one thing that I don't have an answer to, but I keep thinking through, is what is the trade-off, right? How the positive effect of the news, right, for this base of retail investors, who frankly, it's a pretty big aggregate number of investors that have a lot of money.
Yes.
And so there will be an inflow of capital once these things actually, you know, come online and are operational. But does that actually outweigh the, you know, the 10,000 pound gorilla of Wall Street now having the ability to
rehypothecate,
you know, go do what they do, right? Yeah. And so you know, there's an element of is this almost a Trojan horse, right? You know, you get into the fort to attack by saying, hey, we're going to give access to these retail investors. Everyone's cheering, and to your point, they don't see, you know, kind of what's happening in the background. I don't know. Right. And so, frankly, I probably haven't been around long enough in the kind of traditional financial world to really understand how to measure that, you know, kind of pro and con impact. But I think it's one of the most fascinating things because you move from, you know, Bitcoin 4 or 5 years ago was in, you know, billions, tens of billions of, you know, market cap or circulation.
Yes.
Now we're moving into institutions that's on their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Right. And now all of a sudden you're playing with, you know, an institution that 3 years ago or 4 years ago could have just bought the entire supply of Bitcoin.
Right.
And so, you know, you're one of my partners always talks about going straight from high school to the pros. Like, mm-hmm. Bitcoin just went straight from high school to the pros.
Yep.
And are we ready? Right. I don't know yet. And I think that's going to be one of the most fascinating things to watch.
Yeah. Great, great points.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. I know that that this was on short notice, so you're fighting the good fight, and I think that a lot of people are listening. So thank you. Much appreciated.
It's my honor and pleasure to finally meet you. I can't believe we've never actually crossed paths personally previously, and let's just help educate, keep up the good work.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, if you like this podcast and want to help crypto take over Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you're listening to it, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage and scroll down until you see those 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way for us and the entirety of the crypto takeover. See you next time on Off the Chain.